my advice for anyone who calls and says, let's go have coffee, I want to talk to you about this, I want to talk to you about that, about film, is just like, the best thing that you can do is just go make it, because all the tools are there and they're easily accessible this day and age. So if you have an idea, if you have a story and you want to get to the next plateau of any part of filmmaking, whether it's editing or color correcting or directing or screenwriting, you need to just get on it or find a group of people who have those other skills that you need and just go make it and then put it out into the world. If you make what you know you can make in your head and you get it out into the world, there's a really good possibility that somebody will catch on to it.
Hi, I'm Daphne Cohn. Welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations with the artists and makers who use creativity to innovate, disrupt, and elevate. Jethro Waters is a photographer, a director, and a filmmaker. He makes films that weave together poetry and prose while telling stories of amazing men and women like world-renowned photographer Burke Uzzell and singer Angel Olsen. His work has been published in The Guardian, Rolling Stone, Pitchfork, NPR, Spin, and Billboard. And while much of this conversation is about the creative process of filmmaking, there are lessons here for every artist and maker. What it means to live your life as an artist, the best way to get feedback, and how to separate out the advice from words best left ignored. Walking that fine line between art that is uniquely yours yet still speaks to many others. Where to find ideas, and how to know when, finally, the work is done and ready for the world. May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Jethro, to the Creativity Habit Podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So the way I begin is with your creativity story as a child. So how did, I know your art is really about directing with filmmaking and photography. So you can speak specifically to those two, or just art and creativity in general, how they showed up for you as a child.
You know, I think, and writing is really what opened my imagination. Reading The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster was kind of what kickstarted, I think, my creativity into high gear and made me want to create in general. So I read that when I was relatively young. It just was a complete shift in the way my brain processed things. Another turning point came when my dad gave me his old film camera when I was around 14. And as soon as I got a hold of that and then an old video camera, you know, the gloves were off. And that's what I spent most of my time doing, was photographing and making insane movies with my friends like most people do, and making mixtapes of nonsense, you know, but just creating small stories. And when I got into high school, I started writing for the screen and practicing all those different things, and just became a complete cinephile by the time I was in high school. But it really began, what I do now can be traced back to that film camera that my dad gave me and let me run wild with.
Well, okay, I want to go back a little before the film camera to The Phantom Tollbooth. What was it about that book that really changed the way that you saw things, the way that you thought?
You know, there's so many fantastical things that we experience at those ages, because there's so much marketed for us. You know, all those different cartoons that I grew up with, like, you know, G.I. Joe and Thundercats and all this madness that was really insane when you think about it, when you look back and look what I was digesting at that age. But it all just seemed so normal to me, because I was a run around the woods, jump up in trees kind of kid. And so there was something about the different worlds and the idea that Milo got this mysterious package and went through this portal and into a completely different world. For some reason, I guess it was also because I had to really create that world in my mind as I was reading that book. And I'd read other books, all the Beverly Cleary books and all that stuff, which are fun and nice. But something about that book just tripped a switch in me, where I was like, oh, wait, there is an alternate world, you know, in your imagination. That, and I think it was the first time I really realized that somebody was behind it. You know, before I'd never processed that somebody had to make all the things that I was experiencing. And when I read that book, it shocked me just as much in how creative it was and how imaginative it was and how good it made me feel inside to read it and to think about those alternate worlds. But it also made me think about the fact that that's a possibility to live your life doing that.
Wow. So it really did lay a foundation for filmmaking for you. I mean, that's...
It did.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Before, we're going to talk a lot about filmmaking and film and the process, your process, but I did, in doing research, I really could not get totally clear on this, and I looked up in a lot of places and watched videos. Can you explain for me the difference between You're a director. Between a director and a filmmaker, because it sounds like you're both.
Yeah, well, it's really just as dependent on the project, but I would say that filmmaker is a really wonderfully broad term that anyone can use for any part of the filmmaking process. If you're a director, or if you're an editor, or if you're a cinematographer, or, you know, if you're a producer, you can still claim the umbrella term of filmmaker. And you can also, if you're doing all of those things, then you're absolutely allowed to use that. The difference, for me at least, is oftentimes people ask me what I do. I say filmmaker because it encompasses more about what do I do than if I just said director, and I don't have to explain, because, you know, filmmaker, people automatically understand, okay, he makes films. If I say a director, like, director of what? I'm a director of films. But starting from the photography aspect of it, and then working my way backwards into the writing of it, and then learning directing from writing is how the process has worked for me. I know it's not the same for everybody, but I started from thinking about it as a photograph. And then I started thinking about stories and how to construct stories. And then I went and started thinking about how do you use those two tools to direct. So directing for me is basically sewing the story together. You're responsible for making sure that the story starts in a place and ends in a place that is specifically your vision. And obviously in documentary, you need to honor the subject and make sure that you're honestly representing them as well. The director's job is to make sure that that story gets told in the best way possible in a specific vision. A filmmaker can be any number of component parts.
And so when you do start with a film, mm-hmm. how are you deciding which ones that you are going to turn into films? Like, you have, I'm assuming you probably have a lot of ideas for different things you want to create. How do you decide which ones you want to pursue? And what are some of the criteria for making that decision?
It's been interesting because there's been several short films that I've made that were a writing process where a specific idea or something that struck me in an article on Slate or on CNN or on the New York Times, or it was anything that is a little spark of interest, and it could be something absolutely random. But for me, oftentimes when I'm working on something like a narrative, a personal like short film or a feature film that I'm writing, I always get sparks kind of from random association. That's how it's always worked for me is I'll be reading an article or I'll be reading a book, and all of a sudden my mind will get sparked on some specific idea that I think is interesting or nuts or would make an interesting story. And then it just evolves from there. As far as the documentaries that I'm involved in now and have been, those have been primarily brought about by the producer that I work with named David Raymond. And David's an exceptional guy who comes from the art photography world, so we automatically had the same kind of DNA. And we had talked about for 2 years what projects we wanted to work on together, and then he met Burke at a conference and was just realized immediately, this guy needs to have a film made about him. And that's the same for Ralph Burns, who we're also making a film about, who's a photographer local to Asheville, who's just insanely talented individual. Those came specifically from David. David saw those individuals as the amazing human beings they are, as well as having a lot to share through their artistry and their history.
So you work with David around these different films, and when you start on something like this, so you're starting with Raymond, do the two of you come together with some kind of collective vision? Like, what is it that you're wanting to convey, and how do you bring that together as a duo?
Right. It's a very good question, because a lot of times you use a small crew or a handful of people that I know are really good, and we've gone and made films. With David, it's been interesting too, because I had yet to work with a producer who's as there as David is. David's a wonderful producer. When we started F11, David is really familiar with the photo world and has been his whole life, and so he knows most of the biggest photographers in the world. He knew Burke's work, you know, didn't really know much about him, and then he met him and realized that this guy has an incredible story. So he called me and said, hey, I just met this guy, look him up. And as soon as I Googled Burke's name, you know, I knew all of his work. I'd been looking at his work since I was a kid. I was just floored that he's, you know, out there still making amazing work to this day. And so we got together, and he said, this guy needs a film to be made about him. And so we fleshed out, who is Burke? What is it about Burke that needs to be told? You know, and for me, I'm not the kind of filmmaker who goes and makes traditional documentaries. A lot of my work, if anybody can see, is how would I phrase it? It's more magic realism or surreal or strange. You know, it's not very straightforward. So when I talked to David about it, I was like, you know, I don't want to make a documentary that is typical in any way. I want to make as much as we can. Make a piece of art around a brilliant artist, which is what Burke is. Burke's an amazing artist, you know, with a 60-plus year history in the medium. And when we talked to Burke, we talked a lot about what the film should be, and he was absolutely ecstatic about the fact that we weren't going to make a very traditional talking head, starting with, you know, found footage, tell the story of him, what his parents were like, and then end up where he is now. You know, we were like, no. You know, for me, it has to be nonlinear. It has to follow Burke doing what he is now. And of course, we're going to visit all of the things that he has done. But it needs to be as visually engaging and as beautiful as possible to really represent what Burke is about.
Okay, I want to ask you actually something about that. But before I do, why don't you just give a little background on F11 so people know this film about Burke? Like, just give a little context for it as we move forward.
Okay, so Burke Uzzell was the youngest photographer hired for Life magazine ever in the late 50s. He was hired when he was 23 years old and went on to become a member of Magnum with the contemporaries like Henri Cartier-Bresson, Robert Capa, Cornel Capa, Elliot Erwitt, Mary Ellen Mark, all of the greatest photographers of the 20th century, a lot of them at least. So he went on to become a member of Magnum, and later on he was a president of Magnum in the 80s, and has had, and to this day, has never slowed 1 mile an hour, and his focus has been eternally photography. From the moment that he was 12 years old and he got his first box camera, he has been obsessed with photography, and he is absolutely one of the greats. He photographed Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral, the cover of Woodstock that we all know and love. In his archive, we found Hunter S. Thompson, we found Bill Gates, we found Robin Williams. The list is just endless. He's just this seminal figure in the world of photography. Everyone knows his photographs, but not everyone knows his name, and I think that's the case with quite a few photographers who haven't had the notoriety that they should have for their historical and artistic impact on the medium. Outside of that, Burke is just a really interesting individual in general. Because of his drive, he's a 79-year-old man who still takes only small roads on trips all across America to make portraits and make unbelievably amazing landscapes. And he has a very specific style that you can see from a mile away. And he only transitioned to digital photography about 7 years ago. And so lately, he's been focused on the African-American community in Eastern North Carolina and did a museum show for the Greenville Museum of Art in Greenville, North Carolina. He followed him through that process as he was making those portraits of local community members and community leaders in Eastern North Carolina. I did that portrait series for that museum. And then Burke and I took a trip across the country on small roads while he was photographing, as he has done most of his life, though he has some of the seminal works, you know, in civil rights photography and Magnum's history. Most of his archive has been personal works. He has this vast, vast library of American history in his archive. And he's so, so interesting. He speaks so much about the art world and how painters were his real influence for photography. And he has a lot to say about the state of the United States right now versus the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. Been a really incredible journey to take with someone who has been there and seen it all and done it all and continues to make incredible art.
When you make a film about someone, like in this example, one person, Burke Uzzell, With F11, like, how has the making of this film changed the way that you film and act as a director? Like, what have you learned from working with Burke and from making this film?
I've learned so much from Burke, not just so much about directing and about filmmaking, because it's lucky for me that we have, that him and I share, you know, the exact same passions, you know, being photography and lighting and cameras and storytelling and capturing human beings the best way that we can. I've learned a lot about the longevity of art and the longevity of being an artist. And Burke is a wonderful shining example of the capabilities of someone who has never lost their drive to do better work and to make better art and to learn from other artists and live his life as an artist. I think what I've learned the most is just the amount of concentration and dedication that he's had his entire life, continuing to make bodies of work year in and year out that are important. They're important bodies of work. So that's what I've learned the most is just his his humble humanity at the same time. He's a wonderful individual to be around. It's just a shining example of what it means to be a compassionate human being and to translate that into art. That's what I've learned most from Burke. And of course, there's been so many technical tricks here and there with his insane experience with lighting and portraiture and landscape. And it's just been a dream for me to just stand around and him and I will talk shop all day and laugh all the way around the United States. I slowly make notes on what he's doing.
Yeah. And one of the things you mentioned was living life as an artist. What does that mean to you, Jethro, to live life as an artist?
I think that he just lives and breathes photography. There is nothing else for Burke. You know, he does pay very close attention to what's going on in the world and politics and news. And watching him drive around the United States, I noticed that if you watch his eyes and watch the way that he drives, he is only concerned with finding and framing photographs in his mind. Maybe that's not something that somebody can choose to do. You know, maybe that's not a lifestyle that you can just be like, I'm going to choose to be an artist. I'm going to choose to only focus on one thing. I think there's also something to be said for the dedication that he gives his medium and has been willing to change and grow with it. You know, he's not this traditionalist who is unbending to the times and to technology and to what is important in photography and art photography right now. He's watching that. And he absolutely breathes being an artist and taking photos. And it's all he wants to talk about. It's all he wants to do. That's it for him. And it's just really powerful to be presence of someone who is in their sixth decade of doing that consecutively.
And do you find parallels in your own life? I mean, do you feel that you have a similar dedication to filmmaking and photography?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, I do, because it's a joyful obsession for me. That's the best way I can describe it, because it's something that makes each day to be passionate about each day. If I'm looking through reference books, or if I'm sketching down ideas for a story, or if I'm geeking out about a lens that I really want to try out, you know, or if I'm watching films for fun or watching films to study them, which is a lot of the times one and the same, all of that, I realize it's part of an obsession, but it's definitely joyful for me. It's something that I live to do every single day.
Do you find, even though you lived to do it every single day, that there are ebbs and flows within that, where sometimes you really have to motivate yourself to get up and do the art, and other days you're just on fire? Or do you just continuously feel like, yes, this is it, and you can't turn it off?
There's definitely ebbs and flows. I will burn really hot as far as the editing process or writing process for, you know, several days on end, and then I'll take a couple of days where I'm just completely idle, you know, and I'm staring out the windows, or I'm slowly making notes, or I'm rearranging, you know, storyboards or looking at things. You know, it's not something where I'm freaking out and jumping out of my door every single day. Even in the slow idle days, though, like for instance, this is a funny fact, but I end up taking really long showers a lot of the time, because for some reason in the shower, like I will spend 30 minutes just standing there, an hour, and my mental processes are churning really heavily at that time. And as soon as I get out, and I'll go and make just tons of notes based on that. But there's something about that process. I'm sure it has to do with the isolation of it and the noise of it. But I'm really good at idling. I'm a really, really good idler to wander around my apartment endlessly, looking at my plants and watering them and staring, you know, off the balcony, or trying to read something and putting it down, and endlessly picking up things and putting them down. And then some, you know, some days, some weeks on end, I can't stop, you know, editing, or I can't stop doing whatever it is in the process that I'm doing.
And that's an important point, because I know, for me, as somebody who is very, very goal-oriented, driven, it can be hard for me to idle and feel okay with idling. Mm-hmm. And yet that's a huge part of the creative process, is actually letting yourself do nothing. Because different connections in the brain are being made when we're mm-hmm. idle than when we're doing mm-hmm. focused work. And so then we can go ahead and create things we never would have created before. So just wanted to underscore that. The importance of that, and congratulations on being so good.
That would be nice. I appreciate it. I've never been congratulated on my idleness, but I'm happy to accept it.
One of the things I wanted to go back to was, you said with this documentary, and something that you don't do is make traditional documentaries, and I'm wondering mm-hmm. with that is, do you ever feel concerned about the success of something because it's not so traditional?
Absolutely. I absolutely do, because I have to think about it in terms of with Burke, here's this man who has had this incredible career and has this amazing legacy and has done so much. You know, he's an absolute hero of mine, you know, making a film about a hero of mine. And when you think about it like that, it becomes really intimidating. You know, it's just like, okay, you cannot drop the ball on this, and you cannot make something that doesn't do justice to Burke. And it's just really lucky for me that I happen to be making a film about an artist who is all for trying to stretch the medium that you're working in as much as you can, and trying to experiment enough to make something that is transcendent and isn't just another film. Because any number of filmmakers, and really good filmmakers, can go and make a very traditional historical account of Burke's life and tell it well, and it'll be fine because we're used to that, and we like those. But for me personally, it would be doing a disservice to Burke and to everything that I do as a filmmaker. You know, it is intimidating, and it's not easy to think about that you're trying to make something that people still latch onto and still love and still want to know more about the person. But it also, you want to challenge them a little bit as far as straying away from the very traditional media that we're used to when it comes to the genre of documentary. It's intimidating.
Yeah. Well, how much does the audience factor in to your awareness? Like when you're filming, when you're directing, how much are you thinking about the viewer?
You know, I'm thinking about the viewer, but I'm thinking about myself more, because if you go back to the original intention for taking photographs in the first place, I wanted to make something that referenced the things that I've seen before in my life that influence what I do and make those things beautiful. But I always also wanted to make something that was original to my eyes and my vision, and also make that beautiful for everyone. When I'm directing, when I'm working behind the camera, or I'm working with Burke off camera and we're setting up what we're doing, I'm not thinking that much about the audience. Those days are absolute tunnel vision, and I can't really explain it any other way than having absolute tunnel vision towards a part of the story that I know is really important, that I need to capture in a really beautiful way. And navigating that is, you know, especially a documentary, you know, much different than narrative. You're trying to capture something that's happening in real life rather than staging it. But you're also staging things because you need to think about light, and you need to think about how the story is evolving and those kinds of things. I don't consider the audience too much while I'm filming or directing. And the editing process is different. You know, I'm thinking very much about, you know, okay, well, this transition makes sense. And if I do something that's really awkward, if I'm affected by it, I'm an audience member, and it makes me feel awkward, of course, other people are going to be affected by it. And, you know, and I put a rough cut together, and we had a screening for other producers and directors and good close friends last month. And the idea is, it wasn't anywhere close to finish, and it wasn't anywhere near polished or anywhere where I want it to be. But the idea is to get the material in front of people early and find out what they loved and what they didn't. Because as close as I am to the material, and as close as I am to Burke as a human being, some of the things that I adore are because I know him so well now, and I've spent a year of my life working with him. That's also really important to think about. You can't just make some art film, a complete art film that does no relevance to what people are used to, and expect them to understand who Burke is. I have to still play by the rules of, I need to provide enough information for people to really understand who Burke is and what he's about. That's my number one goal.
Well, and it's like you said, I can't remember who said this. There's a quote by a famous writer, a man, where he said that when you're writing, that's exactly what you do. You're in a small room, you write for yourself and nobody else. When you're mm-hmm. editing, the room gets a lot bigger, because now you're editing for everybody else.
Absolutely.
And yeah, yeah. So I did want to ask you, like you mentioned a couple times, how when you were filming, like you're looking at it as the director, you're also looking as a cinematographer. How are you able to hold all of those different pieces at the same time?
You know, I don't know. I think it's just from a matter of the camera becomes second nature. The camera stops being this thing that I have to operate and maneuver and think about. There is the big stressor moments when the sun comes out and blasts your shot, or if, you know, you have to jump out of a car and run around the corner because something really wonderful is happening, or if, you know, there's two people doing something incredible in the room and you're trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to get this? But the camera just becomes an extension. I'll keep one eye open, obviously, looking around the room, and one eye focused on the framing and what's going on. But I think it's just that's basically it. You know, the camera becomes second nature, and doing the adjustments I need to do in the moment just come from so much practice. And then directing is knowing what I need next and knowing where does this moment that I'm capturing fall into the story. The problem with a lot of documentaries and documentarians is that when you roll and roll and roll and roll and you just end up with seas of footage, then you're left with, I have to solely create the story in the editing room. And yeah, a lot of documentaries are created. The story is created in the editing room because you're trying to capture what's happening in real life and figure out how to put it together in an hour and a half. But at the same time, if you try to be as selective as possible on what you're actually recording, if you're watching for moments that you know are really important, that are the keys and the links to the next moment that you need in the story that you have in your head and what's going on, it's easy to not roll all the time. It's easy to be like, okay, I really think something important is probably going to happen soon, and then you roll a minute before you think it's going to happen. So I think that would be my best explanation of that, is that the camera becomes just an extension of the thing I need to capture what's going on, and the directing of it is making sure that I know what came before the shot and what I need after the shot.
That makes sense to me, given what I've seen of your work, because the way that you direct, the way that you make film is so artistic, and I know that's a really broad term, but like you were saying with a lot of traditional documentaries, it's more just the telling of that story in a very traditional way, in a way that we're used to. And when I was watching your videos, it was more this combination of what felt like a painting and poetry. It was like they were all woven together. So it makes sense that when you are acting as the director, that all of those pieces are filtering through your consciousness, because you're not just rolling and rolling and then editing later. Like, that's all part of the way that you're seeing things, is through that lens of an artist and then bringing that on into the film. So,
Can I get you to write the bio from my website? Because that's exactly, there's no way I could have tried to describe what I aspire to do better. I don't know if I've reached it yet, but that's, thank you for saying that, because that's exactly what I aspire to do.
Well, you've definitely reached it, because I just said it. So speaking actually of reaching it and getting there, let's go back a little bit to starting, because like, now you spent a year making this film. How did you get started down the path where you could spend a year?
A lot of that I have to give David Raymond credit for, you know, my producer. Because David, what had happened was I had made a short film with a lot of the artists in Asheville, turned that into this film called Apocryphal Weeks. And it had to do with sculptors that I love in town, and painters, musicians. You know, it was just one of those things that I knew I needed to make it and make it now in Asheville, because there's such a wonderful community here and an important community of artists and makers in Asheville. And so I had made that film and put out the trailer. And David, my producer, you know, so as soon as he saw that trailer, he was like, okay, this insane person is speaking my language, you know. And so he emailed me out of the blue and said, hey, I just watched your trailer and I love everything about it. This is me. This is my IMDb. This is what I've done. And David's done some wonderful things, you know, sitting films with Tribeca and Sundance and those kinds of things. And he's like, we've got to get together and work on something. I was like, oh, absolutely. That sounds great. David is the reason. He's the guy who met Burke and called me and said, you need to meet him. And you need to talk about making a film about him. And then David is also the reason he went and did what wonderful producers do. And he raised the money to make this film. It was a mixture of David looking at my work and my continual work over the next couple of years that we were friends, and him watching, you know, what I was doing, and him saying, this is the right guy to make this film. You know, having seen that trailer, we became friends.
So one of the takeaways I get from that is, make your work and put it out there, because you never know who's going to see it and what it's going to lead to.
No, absolutely. It's a hard thing if you don't feel like trying to become your own branding agent, or you don't want to be a hard thing to try to show your work to people. I mean, maybe it's not for everyone, but it was for me to start, you know, when I really got heavy into making films and being like, okay, you know, this is something I know that I can do and I need people to see it. My advice for anyone who calls and says, let's go have coffee, I want to talk to you about this, I want to talk to you about that, about film, is just like, the best thing that you can do is just go make it, because all the tools are there and they're easily accessible this day and age. So if you have an idea, if you have a story and you want to get to the next plateau of any part of filmmaking, whether it's editing or color correcting or directing or screenwriting, you need to just get on it, or find a group of people who have those other skills that you need and just go make it and then put it out into the world. And that's exactly right, because because I was working for a publisher in Asheville making documentaries, and I was doing music videos, you know, left and right, and doing all this other work at the same time. Every evening of the week and every weekend, I was working nonstop on that short film, and I was doing it with a group of friends, and they were all artists. So of course, they wanted to be a part of it. If you make what you know you can make in your head and you get it out into the world, there's a really good possibility that somebody will catch on to it.
And how did you deal with any of the doubts or the fears that was like, I don't know if I can put this out? Because you really are putting yourself out into the world in a lot of ways.
Anything someone makes is up for judgment the moment you put it out into the world.
Right.
I think that it comes from, assuming my life making things in general, when I realized that, okay, I think this is beautiful, let me show it to some people who will give me an honest opinion, who I can trust. Friends, you know, that will shoot straight with you. You know, there's plenty of people who are just, oh yeah, that's wonderful, and not wanting to hurt your feelings, which is not good for art. You need people to hurt your feelings because you need to get better. And so you need a lot of people in your life who will shoot straight and will hurt your feelings, you know, and because it's really important to self-assess that way. And so, you know, I was always showing whatever I was making to people who would shoot straight with me and tell me what they loved and what they didn't. I think it comes from, you're never going to please everyone. So if you're pleasing 80% of the people who you know are really tough critics, then great.
But how do you separate out, like if you have all these people giving you feedback, how do you then not sit down to do the work you're going to do and have all their voices in your head? Like how do you keep them out of your head so that you still create what is yours?
Right. That's a really good question. And I think the most important people for me that have given me advice have told me that exact thing. And I think that's kind of a litmus test for if you know someone is giving you the right advice or the right opinion, is that they also tell you, but at the end of the day, it's yours, you know, and it needs to feel like yours. You're writing an equation more or less, and you're taking other people's pieces and putting it into it to try to figure out what is advice that did they give me that made sense, that felt right for me. The best thing you can do is try it. Like I run completely on instinct almost all the time. And when I'm making something or editing or directing, it's I'm not looking through this referential chart of other films in my head. If I'm writing, of course I'm thinking, oh wow, I really love this beautiful moment I would like to translate that in my own way. But you know, most of it is all instinct. So in the same way, if you're trying out other people's opinions or they're telling you, this is really bad, you should do this or that, if you try what they say and then instinctually you feel really good about it, you're like, oh, that was right, then you run with it. But if it hits you as an alarm, you're like, no, that's not me, throw it away. You can't be afraid to throw away your own work, and you can't be afraid to throw away other people's opinions of your work as well.
Yeah, that's it. Like right there, I can identify with that. When you say somebody gives you feedback and if it feels right, then run with it, and if it doesn't feel right, then you can let it go. Because I've definitely had that experience where people will give me advice and I'll start to go in that direction and I'll just be like, this just does not feel right. But then other times I'm like, oh god, that makes so much sense. Yes, I totally get it. So again, that's going back to, you're taking in other people's opinions, but you're using your own knowing as the ultimate judge in this
issue. Right.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's one of those things where the most important thing is that you don't let anyone influence, you know, your artistic DNA, so to speak, where they're not actually gene editing on you. But at the same time, there's nothing wrong with this is a terrible metaphor, but, you know, like some person you respect helping you figure out the right vitamins to take. That's for sure. You know, because
right.
at the end of the day, you're going to know in your gut what feels right when you're done. If you take someone's suggestion and you try it.
So speaking of kind of knowing things in your gut, how do you know when it's done?
And this is been the biggest hurdle for me, is that I don't know if they're ever done. And that sounds silly to say, but because there's always an infinite number of possibilities when you're making film, you know, like for basically any medium I know. I never hit a spot where absolutely this is the perfect edit, the perfect mode, the perfect everything. What I look for is, because I know that I can always adjust things, I know that I can always rearrange things, and I've worked with a number of people who want to infinitely make small little changes based on the idea of perfectionism and all, and I don't believe in that at all. I think that it's absolutely essential that your art has imperfections in it. It's silly to say that anything can be perfect, but I hit a point where I know if if I make any more changes, that I'm just rearranging things and I'm not actually affecting the outcome that someone is going to get from the story that I'm trying to tell. That's when I know that I've hit the mark, is when I'm like, okay, this all feels really good to me. You know, these transitions are beautiful. These shots are exactly like I wanted them. And this tells the story I want to tell. Really, it's still really instinctual. You know, I don't really have a test where I'm like, I watch it three times. And if, you know, if my toes don't twitch on any of the times, then I'm done. I'm good. No, it's really just an instinctual thing where it's like, okay, I know that if I continue working on this right now, I'm only rearranging things. I'm not really making an impactful change to the story that I'm trying to tell.
And do you find that in the telling of stories that things like life sorts itself out for you, like that you are able to understand life a little more through the lens? Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. You know, there's been so many moments, F11 and Be There with Burke, that have reinforced that idea for me so many times, because had I not been in the dark room with him the day after the election last year, while he was developing a photo that he took at Martin Luther King Jr.'s funeral and him discussing what was happening now in the country and what was happening then in the country and the comparisons, I think everything that's happened since then would be very different for me. Everything that I would look at everything very differently had I not been there and done that.
Can you say a little more about that? Like how you think about it differently as a result of that experience?
Well, you know, here I was with a guy who was very devastated over the outcome of what had happened. And, you know, I was as well. And it was just a day full of despair. And then we went into the dark room and obviously things got heavier still, because that was just on our schedule to do it that day. That's just the day that was supposed to happen. And then things unraveled like they did. So for me to be there and to be around Burke, who has already been through one end of the world, you know, because he was speaking to the fact that things are really bad. This is a really terrible thing that's happened, but it's not the end of the world. It's like 1968 was the end of the world. You know, talking about here I am with this beautiful man who was killed for wanting a less racial society. And a week later, I was photographing Robert Kennedy's funeral for the exact same reasons, because everyone knew he was going to die because of the way that he spoke out for social justice and civil rights. And me being in the presence of Burke for all of that and documenting that and making art during that was essential for me, because I was actively participating in a way. And hearing Burke reaffirm the fact that, yes, things are bad, but this is not the end of the world, and now the real work has to begin. So that was essential.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to ask you about that, because you also made a short film about the Women's March, which was the day after the inauguration, and you made it about the Women's March in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. What do you see as the role between art and activism?
That really depends on the artist and the artist's intention. That's a very obvious thing to say. But I think art and activism go hand in hand in so many ways, because it's a way to make people pay attention without trying to have a combative conversation or try to shame someone into believing what you believe, which will never work. It's about starting a conversation. I think for the artists who are actively making work that is activism, I really commend those people, because I think it's really important. I think some of the best art, it comes from activism, because it comes from that burning fire of, I need to say something, but I am not a politician, I'm not a public speaker, I'm not any of those things that have a public forum where I can just say what I need to say, so why don't I try to make something tragic or beautiful or shocking or whatever it is to engage with the social commentary that's going on. I think it's really, really important.
I do too. So, okay, before we finish up here, I have a couple things at the end of every interview, but before I get there and before I talk about where people can find you again, anything that I haven't asked you that you wanted to touch on?
No, this has been great for me.
Okay. So for people who want to see more of Jethro's work, go to jethrowaters.com. He has a lot of video shorts on the site. I really recommend you check them out. They're amazing. I mean, I just saw you on Instagram and then I went to your site and I was like, oh my God, these are so good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So I highly recommend checking them out. And of course, F11, when does it come out?
Still working on our festival strategy. So, but I would imagine we'll know what festivals we're going to by around November or December. We won't know for sure, but I would imagine 2018 now is probably early 2018 is when it'll be coming out.
Okay, so you can go to jethrowaters.com for updates for that too. And then the last two pieces are, one piece is a gratitude, and the gratitude that I have for you, I feel like, well, like I said earlier, is the way that you bring, what you bring to filmmaking, this quality of poetry and prose and just the way that you weave all these different elements of art together and somehow bring them in. You're coming from behind the camera, but you bring them to us in front of the camera. And it's, I don't know, you bring something very unique to directing that makes it this whole artistic experience to watch what you've created. And I also feel like there's just a real honesty, a real sincerity to your work. So I appreciate that about you and about the work that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. And Jethro, the last question that I ask is, I believe in the creativity habit as part of the creativity habit, but I deeply believe that every single person is a creator in some shape or form. And many of us are called to make something as creators. And for those of us who are called to make something, why do you think it's important that each person make their thing, that they overcome those fears and doubts and insecurities to put their stuff out into the world in whatever way that means?
I would absolutely agree with you. I think that a lot of the people who become artists or creators or makers or have creative tendencies that become their profession or just their passion, every human being possesses those things. I think some of us choose to run with them, and it might be situational and it might not, but you know, I think it's a lot about choice, you know, finding the thing that you're good at making, because absolutely every human being, there is something that they are exceptional at making. And a lot of it comes from deciding to practice endlessly at it. You know, it's almost never innate, but I would say it's really important for people to chase that down and to put it out into the world, or to choose it as a meditation to do, because there's never been anything more gratifying in my life than working really, really hard to make something that I thought was important, that I thought maybe other people would think was important too. And then realizing that and having that manifest in my life has been the most important thing that's ever happened.
Ah, that's great. And I also want to just reiterate this point that you said about it's almost never innate. There are aspects that are innate, but that so much of making something is the perseverance, is the persistence, to the mastery of it. When I started, I felt like, well, you're either an artist or you're not. You either know how to be a great photographer or you don't. You either know how to be a great filmmaker or you don't. But it's not that at all. It's working at, yeah, go on.
No, that you're saying it absolutely perfect. That's exactly it. It's not innate. You know, some people are more inclined to just pick something up and translate in their head correctly. But just because we try to limit that to instruments, visual arts, and a few other things a lot of the time, you know, there are so many things that would translate really well in their head and that they would be good at. It's a matter of exploring that world of what you can create until you find that thing. But artistry in any way is a mountain, you know, and it's really important that once you start the climb, you don't give up, because if you do want to master something, it's going to be a lifelong journey that you're never really going to get there, but you will get a lot better the more that you try.
That's great. All right. Thanks so much, Jethro. This has been a great conversation.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on your podcast.
I'm Daphne Cohn, and you've been listening to the Creativity Habit Podcast. Head on over to thecreativityhabit.com to read this week's profile, The Rituals, Routines, and Day in the Life of Maker Coco Nuco. Coco is an amazing woman who finds the plants to make the dyes for the clothes that she then sews. Then she sells us beautiful items that adorn our bodies while caring for the earth. You can also follow The Creativity Habit on Instagram. And if you haven't yet, go to iTunes Podcast and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. And then join me next week for another Creativity Habit podcast. Thank you for listening.